Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome, John. Let me add my welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. John was actually asking me a little bit about the Commonwealth Club, and I was happy to brag about the fact that it's a place where people of all opinions and points of view and political persuasions come, and we can hear what they have to say. And it's a rare forum in today's world where you don't just hear one side of the story, right? So I think we should all give ourselves a hand for the fact that there is exists in the world a place like this organization. Well, we're here tonight to principally talk about your brand new book. The title is not one that would make you buy it in an airport store, but the secondary title, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, that would catch my attention. But it's a fascinating story about a circumstance that I suspect many of you are familiar with because it happened right in our own backyard. In fact, I shouldn't use the past tense because it technically continues to happen. And so what I'm going to do is not assume everybody has such a tactile familiarity that we can just get into the subtleties of the stories. Let's start with the basic framework, kind of the executive summary of what brought you to
right.
this book.
Well, I guess I'll explain the story of Theranos.
Right.
A young woman named Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of Stanford University when she was 19 years old in the middle of her sophomore year because she had a vision for a technology that she wanted to create. She wanted to be a successful entrepreneur. She very much wanted to follow in the footsteps of Steve Jobs, whom she admired. And the original vision was for a wristband that would have these microneedles that would draw minute amounts of blood from your wrist and diagnose you with whatever ailed you and simultaneously inject you with the appropriate drug and cure you.
That's ambitious.
She called it the Therapatch.
Yeah.
And in her early pitches to investors, there was a little diagram that showed, you know, the Therapatch. And actually, the Therapatch was more science fiction than it was reality. And she and her co-founder realized that after a few months and pivoted to something that was more inspired by the portable glucose monitors that diabetes patients use to monitor their blood sugar, except Elizabeth wanted her portable device to be able to do every blood test from just a pinprick of blood.
And how many is that approximately?
I mean, if you're talking the full range of laboratory tests, it's anywhere from several hundred to several thousand.
Wow.
No one had been able to do that before, so you know, it wasn't the wristband, but it was still an ambitious endeavor. And she proceeded to build up this company over the next decade, went through several iterations of the technology, and by late 2013, fall of 2013, via partnership with Walgreens, commercialized her finger stick tests in Walgreens stores in two blood draw centers in the Palo Alto area and another 40 or 45 in Arizona, and became a star and a celebrity here and even beyond Silicon Valley. She got a lot of press coverage. She graced the cover of Fortune magazine in June 2014, clad in a Steve Jobs-esque black turtleneck. With a very catchy headline, the CEO is out for blood. And became a fixture on the tech conference, the healthcare conference circuit, was invited to the White House several times, won various awards, was invited to join the Board of Fellows at Harvard Medical School, which is a very prestigious body, and was feted as the world's youngest self-made female billionaire because by early 2014, Theranos had achieved a valuation of more than $9 billion, and she had kept more than half of the equity, and so she was worth almost $5 billion at that point. Hmm. So in a nutshell, that's the story of Theranos.
And we're going to loop back, but one thing that's interesting is, well, two things. One that I thought of when you were saying it wasn't just that these blood tests became available, they became available retail.
So, right.
Right? So you didn't need a doctor to go through.
Exactly. And the first part of Theranos' history, the business model had been different. She pitched pharmaceutical companies, and the idea was that pharmaceutical companies would use these user-friendly, fast, painless fingerstick tests in clinical trials to test new drugs. And so the patients enrolled in clinical trials would have the Theranos blood testing device in their home, and they would prick their finger several times a day. And the results would be beamed to the trial sponsor, and pharmaceutical companies would be able to save billions of dollars on clinical trials or so. Elizabeth mm-hmm. claimed, and it was only later, starting in 2010, that she pivoted to a direct-to-consumer model, yeah. and there were two retail partners that she wooed, and one in particular, Walgreens, is the drugstore chain through which she was able to commercialize the pseudo-technology.
Right. And the other point, just to get our fact base here, is her board of directors. Who was right. the board of directors?
So in 2011, she met George Shultz through someone at the Stanford Medical School. And you all know who George Shultz is, a famous former Secretary of State, crafted the Reagan administration's foreign policy, is credited by many with winning the Cold War. In his 90s now, but remains a revered figure in Republican circles, and he lives right off the Stanford campus, has always been very passionate about science, and when he met Elizabeth Holmes, he was really impressed with what she told him about her technology, he soon thereafter joined her board yeah. and then introduced her to his buddies at the Hoover Institution, the think tank on the Stanford campus. And that's how she got to meet Henry Kissinger and, mm-hmm. and Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense under mm-hmm. Bill Clinton, Sam Nunn, Bill Frist, and some former military commanders like Admiral Roughhead. They all eventually joined the board. And so by the time 2013, 2014 came around, she had this unbelievable board of ex-statemen and retired military commanders who had incredible resumes.
And General Mattis.
General Mattis as well, our current Secretary of Defense. Yeah. Yep.
But there's something interesting there in that they are all really smart, successful people. But what did they know about biochemistry?
That's right. Not much.
Not much.
If you thought about it, I think a lot of people were impressed with this board, and few people stopped to think, but what does George Shultz and what do Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn and Jim Mattis know about medicine and lab testing in particular? And I think there were about 12 men on that Theranos board, and only two of them had any connection to medicine whatsoever. And none of them had any expertise whatsoever in diagnostics. Mm-hmm. So if you thought about that for a second, that was a major red flag.
Yeah. And it was either a tell or it was a great reason to invest.
Right, right. Yeah. And there's this hedge fund based in San Francisco called Park partner fund management that met with Elizabeth and Sunny Balwani, her number two executive, who also happened to secretly be her boyfriend, in late 2013 and 2014, and tried to do due diligence and were essentially bald-faced lied to about many things, including revenue and profit projections and binders of data that weren't real and so on and so forth. But one of the things that really sold them on Theranos was the board of directors. They were really impressed by the, you know, the credentials of mm-hmm. these people, and it didn't occur to them that a startup with a board that was that impressive could be up to no good. Yeah. Not to mention that the lawyer keeping you know, watch on the shop was David Boies.
Yeah, right. Of Bush v. Gore.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. So let's loop back, because a lot of your book is about the culture of the company from where how it started originally and
right.
then how it evolved, particularly when the Walgreens and Safeway situation. So give us some insight into some of the anecdotal examples, for example, of the way the
yeah.
company worked.
So from early on, the culture of Theranos was one of secrecy and paranoia, and Elizabeth liked to compartmentalize information and to you know, keep the overall picture of the device's development to herself, and the communications between, say, the engineers and the chemists wasn't necessarily encouraged. She also fired a lot of people during the early years. There was constant turnover. I would say this culture really went into overdrive when her boyfriend, Sunny Balwani, who was 19 years older, whom she had met when she was just a teenager before even starting her undergraduate studies at Stanford.
And he was a software.
He came from a software background,
right.
and he had gotten wealthy at the very top of the internet bubble when he had joined a tiny startup a few months before the tech bubble popped, and a couple months before it got acquired for some $250 million, and he had walked away with more than $40 million. And so when Elizabeth first met him, coming out of high school, you know, she saw him as this successful, older, successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and she wanted to become successful and wealthy. And so he became sort of her advisor, her mm-hmm. The guy who would teach her about business in Silicon Valley. And eventually they became a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And he divorced the artist he had been married to and moved to Palo Alto, bought a condo. She moved in with him in 2005. And for the first 5-6 years of the company, he was her advisor behind the scenes, but he didn't actually work at the company. That changed in late 2009. At that point, Theranos had burned through $47 million that it had raised in three rounds and was on the verge of bankruptcy, and he stepped in and agreed to guarantee a bank credit line that the company took out to stay afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he joined the company as the number two executive, the president and chief operating officer, and then that early culture of paranoia and secrecy really went to overdrive with him. He had a very short temper, and you know, the firings, if anything, increased to the point that a new expression was coined inside Theranos, which was to disappear someone. When colleagues you know, no longer showed up at the office, you know, their former colleagues would say, well, Sonny disappeared him or her.
Yeah.
You know, as I recount in the book, it was just a constant stream mm-hmm. of firings. There were also people, quite a few employees who left of their own volition, you know, because they had developed qualms and they didn't want to be a party to what was going on anymore. But it was really an unhealthy culture. And I was at Kepler's books last night, doing a talk and a book signing in Menlo Park, and there were quite a few ex-Theranos employees who came.
Yeah.
And, and then a lot of them got in the line, the book signing line, and some of them, you know, didn't know one another because they had worked at the company during different eras. Mm-hmm. And they called themselves Theranos survivors, and I heard them, you know, use this term in the line. So there was an aspect of working at, or you know, largely working at Theranos was not a pleasant experience because of this culture.
The reason I think this is important is not because of the anecdotal nature of it, but because you would expect exactly the opposite in these unicorn type startup companies, particularly ones who are intending to be disruptive in an industry. You would think it would be kind of open space. Everybody talks to each other. The CEO sits with everybody else and talks, and there's chat and crosstalk, and that, because that's how ideas percolate up, right?
Right.
So,
but at a certain point, Theranos really is the story of a young startup founder who had a habit of overpromising to raise money, and with the years, the overpromising got worse and worse, and the gap between where her technology was and what she had promised became enormous, to the point that when they went live with the blood tests in Walgreens stores in the fall of 2013, the gap was so huge that they had to cheat, and they had to hack commercial machines to try to uphold this myth that they had actually created new technology. And part of the siloing and the secrecy and the paranoia became to hide these shenanigans.
Yeah.
And when I finally published my first story in October of 2015, a lot of employees weren't even aware of what they had done in the lab, and weren't even aware that only a few of the blood tests were done with the Theranos device, and that most of them were done with these hacked commercial machines because, you know, they weren't authorized to go into the lab. You needed there was a fingerprint scanner to get in the lab, and if your finger hadn't been scanned and pre-approved, you couldn't get in there, and you didn't know what was going on. So the culture became about hiding not just what they were doing from the outside, but also hiding from many employees on the inside what was going on.
So that's in a sense, I mean, the board was a tell, that in a sense is another tell, because if you were really committed to what you're talking about and felt you could do it, I think you'd operate 180 degrees different. Let's go back to the first, maybe what in my mind at least was the first encounter with underperformance, and that was the Novartis test.
So the prologue is about, of the book is the chief financial officer at the time sees Elizabeth Holmes and several of her colleagues. This takes place in November 2006, come back from a demonstration of the device in Switzerland at Novartis, one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. And, you know, she's excited and happy-go-lucky the way she usually is, but the employees who went with her are not, and they look like something has gone wrong. And so he wanders downstairs, and he tries to figure out what happened, and he approaches Shaunak Roy, Elizabeth's co-founder. And Shaunak wasn't exactly sure what had happened in Switzerland, but after talking to him for a while, he gleans from Shaunak that actually these demos that they've been doing for investors who have been coming by the office are not real, because the blood test results at the end of the demos are pre-recorded and not, you know, in real time. And the CFO at this point, who's been there 8 months, is stunned, because he's the one who's been bringing around all these investors
and making projections.
And he's under the impression that demos were real, and they're certainly under the impression that they're real, and he learns that they're not. And so he decides to confront Elizabeth and goes to her office and meets with her and tells her that this is a line that they can't cross, you know, that it's okay to be aspirational as a startup founder, but you can't you can't essentially lie and mislead investors. That's securities fraud. And she, you know, sort of switch is flipped, and she goes from happy-go-lucky to ice cold, and she looks at him and she says, you know, you're not a team player. I think you should get out of here right now. And it's clear that she doesn't just mean out of her office. Yeah. She means from the company. She means he's fired.
Right.
And I used that scene as the prologue because I knew it was, you know, a good way to hook readers and make them turn the page.
Yeah.
But I also thought that it was emblematic of the fact that at this company, the unethical behavior isn't something that suddenly happened late in the game, where suddenly they were painted into a corner and crossed, you know, and cut corners. It was actually, it started very early on.
Yeah.
And, you know, that scene takes place a couple of years after she's founded the company. She's 22 years old. Mm-hmm. And it shows that, you know, the unethical behavior was part of the DNA of the company.
And then the Tennessee tests.
Right. Then when they were still, so there were three iterations of the Theranos technology, and the first was a microfluidic system. Microfluidics refers to the field that has repurposed the microfabrication techniques that were pioneered by the computer chip industry to move tiny quantities of fluids. And that field was, you know, just coming up when Elizabeth Holmes launched her startup, and there was a lot of excitement about it. And they made a real effort to build a microfluidic blood testing system. Unfortunately, it wasn't working, and she lost patients. She was probably under pressure because she had made all these promises to investors. And so she pivoted away from it. But even as she pivots away from it in late 2007, she's already started a pilot study with Pfizer, whereby the Theranos system has been installed in the homes of terminal cancer patients in Tennessee who are in clinical trials getting anti-tumor drugs, drugs that will arrest the growth of their tumors and hopefully buy them a few more months of life. And you know, back then there were some employees that sort of realized that it wasn't right to use a blood testing system that didn't work at all. And granted, one thing to bear in mind is that back then the Theranos blood tests weren't used to inform the treatment of these cancer patients. It was a validation experiment, and they were to be compared with the regular blood tests that Pfizer was doing the regular way. But employees were still appalled that these terminal cancer patients in Tennessee were being put through these needless, you know, finger stick draws several times a day for a technology that absolutely didn't work. And then in the middle of that pilot study, she pivoted away from the microfluidic platform and to what was essentially a glue dispensing robot. A Theranos engineer ordered a glue dispensing robot from a company called Fisnar in New Jersey. And
it's made to dispense glue.
Right. And affixed a pipette at the end of the robotic arm. The robotic arm had 3 degrees of motion forward and back, left and right, and up and down. And he reprogrammed the robotic arm to sort of mimic what a lab scientist would do at the bench when he was testing blood. And employees, when that pivot to this machine happened, some employees, you know, felt let down because it was a huge step down from the microfluidics, and so they took to derisively referring to this machine as the Gluebot. And Elizabeth Holmes was excited about it. She had a well-known industrial designer named Yves Béard design a sleek black and white case for it to hide its innards, and it had a digital user interface. And she christened it the Edison, after Thomas Edison. Mm. And this happened as they were, you know, this pivot to what was essentially a completely different machine and a much more rudimentary one happened in the middle of this validation study using these yeah. cancer patients in Tennessee as guinea pigs, yeah. essentially.
You remind me, actually, maybe something we maybe went over too fast, is that her whole model was based on using capillary blood as opposed
right.
to blood from your veins. Explain why that's such a big difference.
Well, it's not just the fact that you're getting such a small sample of blood. It's also that capillary blood tends to be polluted by tissue from cells. And it's not as if you're drawing blood from the tip of your finger, you're just not getting as pure a sample of blood as you are when you're doing it with a needle from the arm. And one problem in particular with capillary blood is known as lysis. And when you're pricking the finger and that milking it to get the blood out, often you're putting stress on the red blood cells and they explode. Hmm. And that creates more potassium, that releases potassium, and that creates more potassium than there otherwise would be in the blood. And so a problem that no one has solved with finger stick with capillary blood is the potassium assay. Yeah. It's, you know, there have been studies showing that potassium tests are completely unreliable when they're done on capillary blood. And as I recount in the book, that's one of the big problems that Theranos encountered as well.
Yeah. How do you interpret this obsession with Steve Jobs?
So... well, first of all, you have the history of the Holmes family. Her ancestors were the Fleischmann yeast family, you know, who were some of the richest people in America at the turn of the 20th century. And her father had raised her with, you know, the knowledge of their great success, but also with the knowledge that the later generations of the family had squandered the wealth. His grandfather had lived a very hedonistic lifestyle on an island he had purchased in Hawaii and squandered most of the money, and then his son squandered the rest. And so there was she was raised with, you know, this notion that once upon a time the Holmeses had been wealthy people, you know, at the top of sort of the...
they were elite.
They were the elites of America once upon a time, and that wasn't the case anymore. And so I think she had this desire to recreate that, and she was also Steve Jobs. You know, in Silicon Valley, she was starry eyed about it, and Steve Jobs was very much her idol. She revered Apple. And I think the enormous mistake that she made is that she modeled herself after Jobs and after basically the computer industry, mm-hmm. after, you know, the yeah. traditional Silicon Valley tech industry. And instead, she should have modeled herself after perhaps the biotech cluster right. in South San Francisco, you know, the Genentechs of the world that have right. been doing real medical science for decades now. Mm-hmm. But instead, she chose as her model the computer hardware and software industry, and it wasn't the right model.
Right.
There's been this culture for a long time now in Silicon Valley of fake it till you make it, you know, and the term vaporware was yeah. coined in the early 80s to describe computer software or hardware that right. was announced with great fanfare by a company and then never delivered yeah. or delivered years late without the features that were promised, you know. People like Jobs and Larry Ellison were accused at various points of engaging in this practice.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you looked at it from the point of view of Elizabeth Holmes, she thought, well, that's okay, because eventually they did make it. Mm. You know, these companies did become the real thing with real products, and they were juggernauts, and their founders became billionaires and icons in America, and that was her plan, to use that same playbook. But the problem is you can't really... you can't roll out vaporware in medicine. You know, the medical arena is yeah. a different arena, and the end consumer is not, you know, someone using a buggy smartphone app. It's a patient
right.
Who in this case is relying on a blood test result to make a crucial medical decision.
Yeah.
And I think she either lost sight of that or conveniently ignored it. The traditional Silicon Valley playbook isn't applicable to medicine. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, she tried to apply it to medicine.
Yeah, if my app crashes, it's fine.
Right.
But if I get a false negative on a blood test.
Right. Twitter was famously buggy, in its early years. I mean, it would not work for hours at a time. The consequence was frustration on the part of its users, but right. It didn't put anyone in danger.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Danger.
So speaking of putting people in danger, I want to go to the Walgreens/Safeway part. We kind of have, a general assumption that large institutions have checks and systems in place so that they don't get way out on a limb.
Right.
How did Walgreens where they did?
It's one of the craziest parts of the story. There's a chapter in the book, I think it's chapter 7 of the book, where I recount, Walgreens' attempt at due diligence, if you could call it that. When Elizabeth and Sonny first approached Walgreens, it's early 2010, and they assert to Walgreens that they have this technology that can do hundreds of tests off just a drop of blood very quickly, right. Cheaply, et cetera. In fact, the last iteration of the technology, the mini lab, they haven't even started working on that. They start working on it in late 2010. So anyways, that's a big lie. And Walgreens should have been able to figure that out because they hired a laboratory consultant by the name of Kevin Hunter to kick the tires and to try to check out these claims and to try to do some verification. Mm-hmm. And he even flew out and met with Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny and other Theranos employees twice in 2010. And he started asking tough questions, and he started suggesting that they do things like a 50-patient comparison study with Stanford.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth and Sonny didn't like his questions at all. And after a couple months of this, they told his superiors at Walgreens, "We don't want this guy in meetings anymore." They either had these in-person meetings about once a month or every week, these video conference calls, and they wanted him excluded from the meetings and from the video conference calls. And the unspoken threat was that if Walgreens didn't exclude Hunter from the meetings going forward, that they would walk away, and Walgreens was terrified that Theranos would walk away and then go to CVS, its arch rival based in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
At Walgreens, people had this tunnel vision, which was we're in a battle to the death with CVS, and everything we do is we see it through that prism, and they were terrified that Theranos would turn around, go to CVS, strike a deal with them, and that then they'd be regretting it for the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's fair to say that the fear of missing out, otherwise known as FOMO, played a big role in Walgreens dropping the ball and excluding Kevin Hunter. He remained their consultant for a while longer, but he was kept at arm's length. His role was really, they made it impossible for him to do his job. And as a result, Walgreens never really vetted the supposed Theranos mm-hmm. technology. And then that was a really important part of the story, because everyone who came after assumed Walgreens, this blue chip company headquartered in Chicago suburb that's been around for more than 100 years, mm-hmm. Surely they've done their homework, right? Surely they've kicked the tires. They wouldn't be rolling out a medical technology that people rely on to make health decisions without having done their homework. And so everyone kind of assumed that Walgreens had checked this out, and therefore, you know, if it was good enough for Walgreens, it's good enough for me.
And they, how far down the road did they get with regard to actually testing customers at Walgreens?
They, by the time I started digging into the company, they had commercialized the blood test in Walgreens stores for more than a year and a half.
Yeah.
They were in more than 40 locations, most of them in Arizona. Mm-hmm. They had chosen Arizona because Arizona's policies are very pro-business and light on regulation. That was one reason. And the other was that the Phoenix area has very high concentration of uninsured patients. And Theranos liked to advertise its very low prices. And it's true that it offered low prices, and it knew that the patients who would be sensitive to those low prices were the patients who actually had to pay for their labs, mm-hmm. uninsured patients, because insured patients and Medicare patients have their labs covered by insurance.
What did they do about the fact that the technology didn't work? I mean, so.
Right. I mean, that's where it gets unbelievable. They would try to validate tests on. So the mini lab, which was the last version of the technology, the Edison, the second generation of the technology, was limited in that it could only do one class of blood tests, known as immunoassays. And there are about a half dozen classes of blood tests. And so the mini lab was going to be able to do the other classes of blood tests too. But by the time they rolled out the finger stick tests in Walgreens stores, the mini lab was just a prototype that didn't work. Mm-hmm. It was years from functioning. So they couldn't exactly use that. So they dusted off the Edison, and they tried validating some finger stick tests on the Edison. But according to my sources, I learned subsequently when I started digging into the reporting, the validation experiments that they ran were very shoddy, and they cut all sorts of corners. They ignored data points. I mean, it's very well known in science. You don't ignore any data. You don't eliminate any data points. That's scientific fraud. And they were engaging in this type of behavior because they were trying to get the validation reports for these blood tests to look the way they should mm-hmm. look in order to put the tests online. And so they did put about a half dozen tests online on the Edison that weren't reliable. And because the Edison could only do immunoassays, they needed to come up with a way to pretend that they had technology to do some of these other classes mm-hmm. of tests. So they hacked a machine called the Siemens Advia 1800, which is a big hulking commercial analyzer that isn't at all made to test tiny samples of finger stick blood, mm-hmm. but they had the brilliant idea that they could modify this machine and adapt it to small finger stick samples. And one of the ways they did that is they diluted the blood, the finger stick samples, to create more volume, because the Advia machine was built to test normal sized samples of blood. So to create more volume, they would dilute the blood. And there are several problems with that. One is that there's already a dilution step in the Advia's protocol. So this amounted to double dilution. Mm-hmm. And when you're altering the sample multiple times, you're creating more room for error. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that they were diluting the sample so much that the analytes, whose concentration they were trying to measure in the blood, the concentration got so low that it fell beneath the FDA-approved analytic measurement range of the machines. Mm-hmm. So it meant using these machines in the way that the manufacturer hadn't intended and in the way that the FDA certainly hadn't approved them. And it led to another series of unreliable tests.
Yeah. So that patients now were actually getting.
Right. Yeah. They did about 80 tests using this hacked method with the Siemens machine.
Yeah. Well, we could go on and on about this element, but I think you pretty well established that I will use the term scam. Is that fair? And I want to go now to where you become part of the story. if I can put it that way, where you first sniffed out something was different here and how that led to your investigation.
So Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes first came on my radar when I read a profile of Elizabeth Holmes in the New Yorker magazine in late 2014. At that point, she'd become a celebrity. It had been about a year or more since she had, you know, risen to fame, and she had graced the cover of Fortune magazine 6 months prior. And but for me, that was the first time that I discovered that this company existed and that this young woman had founded it. And then I learned of the company's valuation and of her great wealth. And there are a couple things, but one thing in particular that struck me as odd as I was reading that New Yorker profile on the subway home, you know, from Manhattan to Brooklyn, where I live, which was this notion that a 19-year-old college dropout with just two semesters of chemical engineering classes under her belt, had just dropped out and pioneered, you know, groundbreaking new medical science. Mm-hmm. In Silicon, this has happened before in Silicon Valley. There have been precedents with Mark Zuckerberg, before him Bill Gates. You know, these guys taught themselves how to code and how to program on a computer when they were young. Legend has it that Zuckerberg taught himself how to code on his father's computer when he was 10 years old. And, you know, that's believable. You can do that with a computer manual. And if you spend hours and hours and hours at the keyboard, you can teach yourself how to code. Mm-hmm. But you can't really do that in medicine. In medicine, you usually have to have formal training, go to medical school, often do a fellowship, get your PhD, do postdoctoral studies, do years of research, sometimes decade of research, before you start adding value. And as I say in the book, it's no coincidence that most Nobel laureates in medicine earn their Nobel Prizes in their 60s. Mm-hmm. It takes a lifetime of training and work to add value in medicine. And I knew that. And so I smelled a rat. But to be fair, I might not have done anything with that hunch if I hadn't gotten a tip 3 or 4 weeks later. And the tip came from a clinical pathologist who was based in the Midwest, who wrote an obscure blog called The Pathology Blog. And he spelled it B-L-A-W-G. And I don't know how many readers he had, but I would speculate that it wasn't much more than 10. Yeah. And, I had come across him the previous year doing a series of stories on Medicare fraud and abuse, and I had sought his assistance trying to understand laboratory billing and how clinical labs billed Medicare. And he had patiently explained the arcane art of laboratory billing to me, and I'd used that knowledge to expose this scam at a network of cancer centers. But I hadn't spoken to him at that point in 7 or 8 months. And he called me because he had read the New Yorker story too, and knowing a thing or two about blood testing, had been immediately dubious about the claims in it, and had quickly posted a short skeptical item on his blog. And he had been contacted almost immediately by a little band of Theranos skeptics, one of whom was this guy, Richard Fuse, who had been a childhood neighbor of Elizabeth and her parents in the 80s when they lived in Washington, and was a medical inventor and entrepreneur. And this is sort of a crazy plot twist, but when Elizabeth dropped out of Stanford and founded Theranos, he and his wife Lorraine were still friends with the Holmeses, and Fuse is a very proud, you know, I would say even vain man, and his pride was hurt that the Holmeses hadn't sought his advice, even though they knew very well that he had decades of experience patenting medical inventions building companies and selling companies and so forth. And so, and at the same time, he thought Elizabeth's vision had merit. So he had gone on the Theranos website, checked it out, had listened to an interview she'd given on NPR in 2005, and had figured out that there was this one part of her vision that she probably hadn't patented, which was the alert mechanism to alert doctors when a blood test result is abnormal. Mm. And he had gone ahead and filed a patent and patented that. And, you know, which is probably not a very nice thing to do. And she and her parents didn't immediately know he had done that, but eventually did, because patent applications are made public in the USPTO's database 18 months after they're filed. And then Elizabeth had come to develop this theory that he had used his son, John Fuse, who had worked at the same law firm that Theranos had used briefly for its patent work. And she had developed this theory that John Fuse had stolen information from Theranos' own provisional patents and given it to his father. Mm. And I looked at those allegations very closely and the litigation that arose from them, and came to the conclusion that what Fuse had done wasn't very nice, but he had not stolen any information from Theranos. But she did sue him. She sued him in 2011, and that lawsuit, that litigation, went on for 3 years. And she hired David Boies to litigate that case. And throughout the litigation, Fuse, you know, who had a background in medicine and was a trained physician, had become convinced that Theranos was a scam. Yeah. And so he told, you know, the pathology blogger of his experience and his suspicions. And it helped that he also had just made contact with a an employee who had just left Theranos, who was the outgoing laboratory director. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard that, you know, I was very conscious of the fact that the pathology blogger was like three times removed from any, you know, primary information, right. And that Fuse himself, whom I talked to as well, was a secondhand source. But the fact that I was being told that there was a primary source, right. Who had just left the company and was alleging, you know, all manner of wrongdoing, got my ears to prick up.
The lab director.
The lab director. Yeah. And so from then on, it was, you know, my mission was to get this lab director on the phone and make contact with him. And I did after a couple weeks, and he was terrified. He was being hounded by Theranos lawyers. He had sent a bunch of emails to himself, to his Gmail account, and they were pressuring him to delete them. He had hired a lawyer. She was not she definitely wasn't competent to take on his case and go up against Boies, Shiller, Flexner, and so she was intimidated by the heavy-duty lawyers on the other side, and he was under all this stress. And so he would only speak to me if I granted him confidentiality, and so I did. Mm-hmm. I figured, you know, all I had were rumors and innuendo if I couldn't get this guy to talk. And I promised him I would treat him as an anonymous source, and I would guard his identity, which I still do to this day, because he's identified in the book under a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. He goes by Alan Beam, which is not his real name. And during that first phone call with Alan Beam that must have lasted an hour or more, I learned about, you know, the fact that very few of the blood tests were actually done on Theranos technology, that these Edison machines were faulty, that most of the tests were done on commercial instrument, that, you know, that they had modified, that Elizabeth and Sonny were a couple and were hiding it from the board of directors, from employees, from the public. You know, Henry Kissinger had been quoted in the New Yorker piece as saying that he and his wife had tried to set Elizabeth up on dates. Hmm. So it was clear she was lying, yeah, to her board about the relationship. So I pretty much immediately knew this was a big story, and especially the part about, you know, gambling with patients' health and, yeah, lives. At the same time, the journal wasn't going to let me go to print with a story based on just one source, however good that source was, if the source was anonymous. And so it became a game of corroboration. And over the ensuing months, I set about corroborating what Alan Beam was telling me. And that's how I came across other former Theranos employees, mm-hmm, one of whom was Tyler Schultz,
right,
who was George Schultz's grandson. And Tyler Schultz had worked at Theranos and had worked there 8 months and come to the conviction that it was a fraud and that it was a scam during his 8 months. And at the tail end of his 8 months, had tried to alert his grandfather and open his eyes to what was going on. And George hadn't believed him. And so he'd had to leave Theranos and keep all of this bottled up for a year. And then when I started poking around and calling a lot of his ex-colleagues, he heard that this journal reporter was poking around. And so he looked me up on LinkedIn. Mm. And at that point, Alan Beam had told me about Tyler and said, you know, he might be someone you can try as well. And I thought the connection with the grandfather was interesting. And as you know, LinkedIn has this feature that enables you to see who's checking out your profile. And so I immediately noticed when Tyler Schultz checked out my profile.
Yeah.
So I sent him an in-mail through LinkedIn, didn't hear back for a month, and was making headway, with the story in other ways. And then when I had sort of lost hope that he would get back to me, my phone rings one afternoon in the Journal newsroom, and it's Tyler, also terrified, very nervous, calling from a burner phone because he was worried that Theranos would somehow trace our communications. And I had to grant him confidentiality as well, otherwise he wouldn't talk to me.
Thank you.
But once I did, he gradually got comfortable, and I could tell he wanted to unburden himself, and his story came pouring forth. And that added a pretty unbelievable twist to this whole Theranos story, the Tyler George axis.
So last part of this, though, is you finally decide to publish, right?
Right.
October 6, 2015.
Yeah, and the company, Tyler had good reason to be paranoid, and as did Alan Beam, because the company did eventually figure out that they were among my confidential sources and threatened them. And there's a surreal incident that's recounted in the book about the way Tyler was ambushed by Theranos lawyers at his grandfather's own house. And then had to withstand months of legal threats. Theranos wanted him to sign documents, basically recanting, and also naming my sources. And Tyler withstood this pressure and never caved. And so in large part, thanks to him, I was able to go to press with the story in October of 2015.
So what the... last thing, I want to get to audience questions, obviously, because they're better than mine. Tell about how you were treated once you published the story. And, it's like...
Yeah. So the story was published on October 15th, 2015, which I think was It was a Thursday, I think, and Elizabeth Holm was in Boston for her first meeting of the Harvard Medical School Board of Fellows. And so she went on CNBC, and she did it from Boston. She spoke to Jim Cramer, and Theranos had let it be known that, you know, she would basically rebut the Wall Street Journal article. At that point, I was already working on a second day story because I'd gotten wind before we went to bed with the first story that the FDA had inspected the company, but I hadn't gotten confirmation. And I was finally able to get confirmation the day that the first story was published. And so I immediately was on deadline with the second story. But she came on Cramer. It must have been like 5 or 6 in the afternoon, right. New York time. And so
that's that Mad Money program.
Yeah. So I was standing over the shoulder of a Page One editor who was editing my story, and we both stopped what we were doing and turned up the volume on the TV to see what she would have to say. And she played the role of the aggrieved startup Silicon Valley entrepreneur who, is being attacked by a reporter in league with you know, her competitors, namely Quest and LabCorp, and this entrenched duopoly that you know is pulling my strings, and then Kramer, although it's a friendly interview, does ask her about some of the allegations in the article, and she proceeds to dodge and bob and weave. And then the next day, or that night, she flies back to Palo Alto to address what is beginning to be a growing crisis, because then my second story comes out that reveals that the FDA has just done an inspection and has taken away from Theranos the ability to use its little blood vial, which effectively meant that Theranos could no longer do finger stick testing. Mm-hmm. And that evening, late afternoon, California time, she and Sonny gather employees in the cafeteria of the Theranos headquarters on Page Mill Road in Palo Alto, and she gives a defiant speech about how, you know, I'm just this biased reporter who's out to get her, and this and my reporting is seeded by competitors and by disgruntled employees, and how she's going to take on the Wall Street Journal. And the Wall Street Journal is a tabloid, she says. And then Sonny goes on, and he gives a sort of a defiant speech as well. And 3 months earlier, the FDA had approved one of Theranos' finger stick tests, this herpes test. And it had been a big moment of victory for Theranos, and they had celebrated in that same cafeteria. And Sonny had led the assembled employees in a... I don't know if I'm allowed to say this word, but in an FU chant.
Yeah.
And the FUs had been directed at Quest and LabCorp. And at the end of the... Now we're back to 2 days after my first story. And toward the end of Sonny's speech, one of the senior hardware engineers asks him if he can lead them in another chant. And everyone immediately understands what he means, which chant he means, and Sonny is, of course, happy to indulge him, and so they start chanting, F-U, carry roo, F-U, carry roo. And then about a week after that, she came to our technology conference in Laguna Beach. A lot of people were wondering whether she would come, and she came with her big security detail, and she sat on stage and sat through half an hour interview with our technology editor. And there was so much interest in the story at that point that the Journal live streamed it on its website, and I couldn't go out to California. Right. So I watched it from the newsroom in New York, and she told one bald-faced lie after another. Right. Over the course of that half hour, and I was really suspected that she would come out swinging and that she would deny, but her willingness to lie in public in front of an audience and really say things that were verifiably false, mm-hmm. I thought was stunning. And so the early parts, the early weeks after the story were. The response was that the Wall Street Journal is wrong and we're fighting this, and you know,
right,
John Carreyrou is a rogue reporter.
I suggest that when you read this book, just like they say, don't use your computer, you know, like a half an hour or 45 minutes before you want to go to sleep. Don't read the latter part of this book before you want to go to sleep. It gets to real John Le Carré page turner. I want to go to the audience questions
sure.
because they're really good ones. I'm not going to be able to get to all of them, but I'm going to try to consolidate some themes here. One of them, I think, suggests that a lot of scams start off as scams.
Yep.
But that this did not. This started off as a bona fide effort.
Right. She didn't. I fully believe that she did not drop out of Stanford at 19 with a premeditated plan to defraud investors and to put patients in harm's way. She dropped out as this idealistic, young entrepreneur or would-be entrepreneur who really did want to follow in the steps of Steve Jobs, and she had this idea, this cool idea, and she wanted to make it happen, and she had this charisma, and she raised a lot of money over the years and made some progress building a device, never really got there, and soon started, you know, over-promising and lying and exaggerating, and the lies got bigger and bigger, and over the course of 12 years, it became a giant lie.
But she always intended to catch up, right?
I think in her mind, her attitude was the ends justify the means. Mm-hmm. It's okay if I cut all these corners. Yeah. It's okay if I tell all these lies, because eventually I'll get the technology to deliver on what I've promised, and it will work, and then it will be a great advance for laboratory medicine, and it'll be for the good of society.
Yeah, when you see her interviewed, she's quite passionate about the long-term social benefit of.
And I think a large part of that is genuine.
Yeah, that's the point. And there, many people are curious about. So, what has happened to the company now?
Mm-hmm.
The
Elizabeth Holmes laid off another 100 employees about a month and a half ago. So the headcount of the company is now down to about 20 people. It's a shell of what it was. When I started digging into the company, it had 800 employees and had this beautiful new headquarters on Page Mill Road in Palo Alto. They have long since abandoned that pricey real estate, and now that the 20 employees left are in a manufacturing facility across San Francisco Bay in Newark. The SEC has charged her and Sonny and the company with fraud. She settled the fraud charges without admitting or denying wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. She was fined $500,000, relinquished most of her shares and her controlling interest in the company, and agreed to a 10-year officer-director ban in a public company. A lot of people feel like that's a very light punishment, given the magnitude of the wrongdoing, and mm-hmm. that it's really a slap on the wrist. And to those people, I say, don't forget that there's another investigation that's ongoing, a criminal one, mm-hmm. spearheaded by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I'm told that's pretty advanced,
yeah.
and that criminal charges are very possible. And even likely. In terms of the company probably has another 2 months before it runs out of money, yeah. and then will be liquidated. I expect it to cease to exist by August.
And another kind of overarching question that appears here is, what have we learned from this? I mean, the VC community, what have they learned? The Walgreens, and everybody was affected by this. Are there takeaways?
Right. I mean, I think that in recent years, we've come to lionize, you know, these tech entrepreneurs. Who create these companies and become fabulously rich, and whose, you know, creations do impact our lives. When you think about Facebook and Twitter, right. you know, these are products that we use every day. We tend to forget that these are young people, barely adult. You know, she was 19 years old when she dropped out, basically mm-hmm. a kid. With the amount of money that's gushed in the Silicon Valley, in large part because the Fed has kept interest rates at rock bottom for 10 years after the Great Recession, so people were no longer able to get returns from traditional investments like mm-hmm. bonds. And so I think that contributed in a big way to this enormous flow of money into Silicon Valley. And people like Elizabeth Holmes and these young founders were able to dictate the terms and mm-hmm. to do whatever they wanted, and to, in Theranos' case, keep more than 99% of the voting rights.
Yeah.
The board of directors couldn't even reach a quorum without her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was not a real board of directors. It had no power whatsoever. And it's also given rise to this situation where these companies, because they have access to so much money in the private markets, put off going public for a long time and are able to continue operating not in a transparent way, at least not as transparently as they would have to if they IPO'd and they suddenly had to, put out earnings every quarter and put out annual reports and answer analyst questions.
And peer review.
And then I would say another big lesson here is that she modeled herself after the traditional Silicon Valley, the Silicon Valley that started with the microprocessor industry in the 50s and 60s that became the personal computer industry, became the internet industry in the late 90s and is now, essentially smartphone apps and companies like Uber. But that's not medicine. And increasingly there is a convergence between traditional tech and health.
Particularly with AI coming in.
Right. And so increasingly there's going to be this convergence. And I think the Theranos story is really a cautionary tale to tech founders and VCs and everyone involved in this health tech space that you always have to remember that when you're building a device that is ultimately a medical device used for medical decisions, that your end customer is the patient,
right,
and that you should always have the patient in mind, and that vaporware doesn't fly.
Right, or the blue screen of death. Yeah. The last question, because one of the lingering, and from here again, one of the lingering thoughts that she had, which was really a paradigm shift in medicine, was the retailization, I'll call it, of blood testing, so that we could go to Walgreens and find out what our cholesterol level is or whatever we were interested in. Is that going to occur, do you think?
I mean, that was not necessarily a bad idea. One of the ironies of the Theranos debacle is that Safeway, invested $350 million in remodeling the pharmacy sections of its supermarkets. And for years now, these little clinics have been empty. But in the past couple of years, Sonora Quest in Arizona has reached a partnership with Safeway and is offering blood tests to retail consumers.
Yeah.
Hopefully Sonora Quest is, their results are more reliable than Theranos. One thing to bear in mind about Theranos is it liked to, and Elizabeth liked to advertise how low the prices were, but that was a fiction too. It was not a fiction in the sense that Theranos wasn't offering those prices. It was, but what was a fiction was that the company, that was a business model that could work and that the company could actually make money that way. There really was no secret way that Theranos was going to make those low prices profitable. It had the same costs as other labs. And in lab testing, there are enormous costs, cost of equipment, cost of personnel, cost of shipping.
Right.
The blood samples is an enormous cost.
And regulatory costs.
Yeah. And regulatory costs. And Theranos had made none of those costs really go away. So that was a mirage. The low prices were not something that was sustainable.
Well, we are out of time, but there's two ways for you to follow up on this. Number one is get this book and read it. And the second is wait for the movie to come out. Tell us who is. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.